Good evening, folks. This is Franz Weinschenk, your host on Valley Writers Read, welcoming you to a delightful and interesting memoir all about growing up on a grape ranch right here in the heart of the valley, adjacent to the San Joaquin River. Our author is Erlene Holguin, who lives in Madera and titles her story Vineyards of the San Joaquin Valley. Here she is to read all about being a youngster and growing up right in the heart of our valley. Erlene Holguin reading Vineyards of the San Joaquin Valley.
I see trees of green, red roses too. I see them bloom for me and you. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world. I see skies of blue and clouds of white, the bright blessed day, the dark sacred night. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world.
Vineyards of the San Joaquin Valley. The River. California's summer days were hot and often humid. The temperatures in the sandy fields in which we worked often exceeded 100 degrees. The sweltering heat beating down on us during the harvest of the grapes in the San Joaquin Valley was sometimes brutal. Those fields of grape were filled with much learning, much life experience, and often much laughter. Years of memories lived a lifetime ago. The oasis we sought came to us as privilege, garnered only after a long day's work, very long days in fields near the San Joaquin River. Our day, however, did not begin on that particular farm, but on the 80 acres in the neighboring county of Madera. Those 80 acres surrounded the family home I shared with my parents and 9 brothers and sisters. Today's mission would be the work of the harvest on the river ranch. I had never known the 21 acres to have any name but that, River Ranch. Our days began early with a quick breakfast of hot oatmeal and warm chocolate at home. The gloves, scarves, and hats we donned were not the refinery special to Sunday's activities, but the necessary equipment and attire which prepared us for battle. Attendant to the harvest at hand were the challenges Mother Nature had to offer. Hats to protect against the onslaught of the powerful midday heat, scarves to absorb sweat, to ease quick entry and exits from beneath tangled vines, and gloves to protect from the ravages of pinching wire and long tentacled vines which bore the fruit we so carefully harvested. Vines were cut away and swept with a simple flick of the wrist from short, curved, and sharpened blades of specialized grape-cutting knives. The blade was curved so that one might easily reach around the stem of the grape bunch and give a swift tug on the knife's handle. This quick action released the bunch from the vine. Supported by the opposite hand, the fruit was then quickly placed or dropped into the waiting metal grape pan. Much care was taken to prevent unchecked flailing, which could result in an errant knife being swept across fingers or exposed arms. At 3/4 to full, the pans were then emptied onto oblong paper trays. Strings of trays were set along the never-ending rows of vineyard planted in sandy soil. There, on that hot soil, they baked under the valley's sizzling heat for several days. The process of developing raisins had begun. There is little guess as to our favorite time of day. This, of course, was the time for lunch. On weekend days, bologna sandwiches, soft drinks, and cold watermelon were a treat at our family picnic spot on the San Joaquin River, our personal and private beachfront. A path well worn by truck and tractor trailers led down to the river. The trail, a few short yards from the river's edge, required careful foot navigation by all of us. First Mom and Dad, toting large brown bags containing tablecloths on which our feast would be spread, and Dad carrying his midday nap blanket under one arm. His long days began in the early hours of 4 and 5 each morning, requiring rest and escape from the summer's hot sun. 4 boys and 6 girls followed, holding hands, backs of shirts, or belts, while navigating the steep and narrow winding path. No one dared take a misstep for fear of sending us all tumbling into the chilly waters below. Upon arrival at the clearing where we'd spend the next couple of hours, each of us quickly shed all our extra shirts, shoes, and socks. We had learned long before always to wear swimsuits or shorts under our work clothes on Saturdays. It was then the race began to the lower trail that took us to the shallow waters near the train trestle. The quiet of the river, with its ebb and flow that called to small fish and dragonflies, leisurely skimming the waters, gave way to the magic of the river, trickling, gurgling water that brightened the colors of the dry rocks and made flakes of gold in the sand glitter in the bright sunlight as it meandered around our sunburned legs and feet. The quietness gave way to shrieks of delight, laughter, and, of course, name-calling as we pushed each other or purposely tumbled into deeper parts of the swim areas to which we had been restricted. The loudest of all of those sounds which we experienced on the river as we played always gave us fair warning. As a small child, the very first time I experienced it, my fright was such that my brothers and sisters each affirmed that my heart was about to pop out of my chest. It later became a symbol and nostalgic reminder of summers on the San Joaquin River during the harvest of the grape and the turning of the raisin. The train! We all yelled in unison as the very ground beneath us began trembling. The larger-than-life mass of black and red steel lumbered toward us as it navigated the tracks, which were anchored on the elevated trestle under which we played. Louder and louder the trembling became, thunderous noise building to a crescendo as the train approached. Then came the piercing and deafening train's whistle. Our hands flew up to the sides of our heads and covered our ears in order to muffle the sounds. They became less intimidating and much less intrusive as the conductor, his head, shoulder, and arms stretched out of the engine's window and with the biggest grin on his face, gave us a hearty wave. This followed by another shrill whistle. We all responded with cheers, frantic waving, and whistles of our own as the locomotive passed and was no longer audible. Awed by the passing of the huge train and its friendly conductor, we had made a connection. The train, the conductor, so high overhead and so much larger, chugged past, taking a little bit of our childhood along, leaving experiences we would never forget. In the distance, the orange-colored caboose silently became much smaller and disappeared down the quickly narrowing track. We continued to watch until the river beckoned us back to the slow meandering waters that brushed against reeds, cattails, and dry scented river grasses. Our reverie broken only by the stronger, commanding voice of my father calling to us, "Let's go. The vineyards won't wait." Sounds of Summer. The rooster offered a wake-up call, crowing his alarm that began our day. The sound of Papa's tractor hummed in the distant vineyard. The familiar yellow bi-winged crop duster buzzed louder as it dipped and released its cargo. It rose again, turned back, and repeated its pattern each time, powdering the vineyards below with the precious goods that would help Papa bring the year's harvest to fruition. These were the sounds we grew up with here in the San Joaquin Valley, the sounds of summer mornings. Just as memorable was the sound of the tempo of Mama's rolling pin, click, 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 a cadence set as she prepared the several dozen tortillas for the day. The music that accompanied her was the familiar ranchera, the lilting melodies of her favorites, and I'm certain the sounds Papa grew up with. Classic music sung by Mexico's greatest vocalists, accompanied by musicians and mariachi, Vicente Fernandez, Mariachi Varga, Trio Los Panchos, the list went on forever. These were the sounds of security we'd grown up with, the all's well in the world, all that could be counted on in our hearts and minds. Our home remained busy and productive. We were taught self-sufficiency and at the same time learned to count on each other, brothers and sisters, mom and dad. A never-ending circle of trust, well managed by parents fiercely protective of all that was ours and who gave and shared as necessary. It had been a relatively quiet summer day on Road 35, a morning where Mama was hanging the wash. The large wicker laundry basket was loaded to the brim. There were clothespins hanging off her bright multicolored apron, some in the basket, and an extra pouch of the little wooden pinchers. It hung on, the second clothesline within reach, ready for the next load of blue denim jeans. Judging from the tattered and worn knees on most of the jeans, it appeared that Mama would have her Singer sewing machine out in the next day or so. Wash on Sunday was not unusual, as sometimes, especially around harvest time, Saturday chores were saved for a slower-paced Sunday. The wash continued while the aroma of yeast rolls baking in the oven seeped into every room of the house and drifted out to the yard, beckoning and urging us to finish chores as dinner was around the corner. That quiet, peaceful day was not to last. With all the bustling in and out of the house, by children playing tag, laundry baskets and dog food delivery for King and Duke, our German shepherds, and a chow named Smokey, the kitchen screen door, with a latch that didn't latch, was flung open and stayed open. No one knew what happened or how it happened when suddenly, on that quiet Sunday morning, we heard the most terrifying, gut-wrenching scream we had ever heard. It was Mama in the kitchen. What horrible thing could be happening? We all dropped what we were doing and raced toward the house. Some of us ran toward, and then ran away as we encountered laundry basket, laundry, and clothespins flying out the door, and Mama right behind, eyes as big as saucers. With a terrified look on her face, she screamed, "Quick, get your dad!" Through the cacophony of noise, someone made sense of it and ran to get Papa, who luckily was not at the back 40. Papa did not like to be disturbed when he was working on the back 40, nor any time, really. However, he was approximately 300 yards away working on the discs attached to the old John Deere when he was alerted to the problem. Oh, yes, and the trusty guardians? They, too, had raced toward Mama when they heard her in distress. However, found a better vantage point approximately 15 feet from the kitchen door. And while they knew not at what they barked, they continued their dutiful and gratuitous barking at a faster, louder, and more intense pace as they saw Papa approaching. No one could doubt the determination and empowered look Papa maintained as he plowed across the sandy lot toward the house in his characteristic John Wayne gait. Certainly no one questioned what he was going to do when he went to the wooden rack in his office and took out the largest shotgun he owned. We certainly did not know. All we could do was cower outdoors behind King, Duke, and the chow named Smokey. We could see Papa through the open door as he raised the shotgun and took aim at the arrogant little critter. It pranced across the floor near the base of Mama's white kitchen sink, unaware that it was about to take a long trip to that place called Smithereens. Again, the quiet on Road 35 erupted into louder barking and continued screaming by all of us as we heard the first big kaboom. Dead silence. The black and white striped critter scampered at a brisk pace back toward the door, reversed its direction, and was near the oven where the yeast rolls were baking when Papa took careful aim again. Kaboom! The wonderful scent of yeast rolls was now elevated to nauseous as it blended with an odor so foul, filling our home and our lives almost forever. That quiet day on Road 35 in Madera, California, I learned that Papa would always be our larger-than-life hero, but never bother him while he's working. Oh, yes, and that China sits directly behind Smithereens, and for several months it could be seen through the two holes Papa left at the base of the kitchen sink. 12-gauge? Yep, that's the one that makes big holes, right? Along the dusty path. Two little girls awakened that bright sunny morning in August to the crowing of a rooster in the distance. It was summer vacation, and this Saturday morning, like every other, was the best day of the week. Today they had only one important chore, the gathering of eggs. A formidable rooster marked the only possible barrier to a quick and easy morning. 8 and 10 were their ages, one with light brown hair and golden highlights, which had only recently begun to turn from the light blonde, naturally curly hair she'd been born with. The 8-year-old had shoulder-length, cold black hair, which was often pulled back into a ponytail and secured with a rubber band. Her shiny black hair was rivaled only by round, sparkling dark eyes, eyes so dark their pupils were lost in the depth of them. Now, right outside their bedroom window, the rooster crowed a second time. Bija, I whispered. Bija, get up, I whispered louder as I tugged on the light cotton sheet she was loosely tangled in. Betty Jean was a year and a half older than I. Leave me alone, she groaned as she flipped the sheet over her head. It isn't even morning, she whined. Yes, it is. Papa's gone and Mama's already making tortillas. The sound of the rolling pin echoed from the kitchen. She's going to need the eggs before breakfast, I persisted and gave the sheet another tug. Come on, we can beat the guys if we go now. Okay, okay, I'm up. She slowly unrolled herself from the sheet now wrapped around her leg. With a swift kick, she flung the sheet away and tumbled over and off the side of the small twin iron bed. We peeled off light cotton nighties and jumped into our favorite summer outfits. Khaki shorts with oversized pockets to hide any number of treasures we'd find on our excursions around the ranch. Cotton sleeveless shirts we'd tied at the waist in a big knot with loose ends that reminded me of long rabbit ears hanging over our waistbands. This completed our ensembles for the day. No shoes required. We then quickly brushed our teeth and ran brushes through our hair. Mine was silky and combed out easily. It required only a little dampening at the temples to get the thickness of it all to lock into rubber bands that would remain in place the entire day. My sister's hair was blonde and naturally curly, which meant that only Mama could tell if she'd left yesterday's braids in. If she had, the curls would simply multiply around her face. Hurrying toward the kitchen, we each attempted to get to the screen door before the other. Mama was quick to catch us. "And where do you two think you're going?" "Eggs, to check the chickens," we simultaneously responded. "Beds made?" While tossing our hands up in the air and with exasperated sighs, we ran back to our shared bedroom, pulled sheets up, tossed pillows against iron bed frames, and raced through the kitchen again. This time, we heard not a word as we reached the kitchen door but looked over our shoulders and saw Mama standing there near the stove with her hands on her hips. She had only to look at us and over to the kitchen table where a fresh, buttery tortilla, scrambled eggs, and a cup of warm chocolate awaited each of us. We quickly crossed ourselves, gobbled down the carelessly fashioned burrito, and tried to tell her that chocolate was too warm for a hot summer day. Mama looked at both of us with her no-nonsense look. However, every day thereafter, we were allowed to mix our own Nestle's chocolate mix into fresh cold milk. This, of course, only throughout summer vacation days. Grabbing the wire basket from the pantry, we raced toward the chicken coop. It was a battle to get to the newly laid eggs before we raised the interest, or ire, of El Diablo Rojo, the Red Devil. The cranky rooster who patrolled the ranch and kept especially close to the chicken coop came by that name naturally following an especially vicious attack on my little brother Richard. Another early summer morning, the red rooster, with long, purple, red and black tail feathers, gave chase and sank a talon into my brother's left calf. While he survived the painful and frightening attack, neither of my younger brothers was required to return to the chicken coop. The gathering chore was then immediately delegated to my sister Bija and me. If our mission was interrupted by the evil rooster, we were on our own today as everyone else was very busy. Creeping silently toward the chicken coop, we continued across the yard, carefully looking down and over our shoulders. If we made it to the door, once in, all we needed to do was secure the latch until the eggs were gathered. We could then exit when the threat of Diablo's sharp claws was gone. As we approached the chicken coop, we thought we heard movement behind the structure. However, no rooster materialized. We began to hum as we gathered the dozen or so eggs, then crept back to the door. My sister reached up to lift the latch. She quietly pushed the door forward while looking back over her shoulder to assure me that it was safe to exit the coop. My eyes grew as big as saucers as I watched the demon rooster who'd appeared out of nowhere jump high into the air and fling his total weight against the door while he screeched loudly and flapped his wings. We both let out blood-curdling screams, and the small wire basket laden with fresh brown eggs flew into the air. The chaos stifled the chickens cackling, screeching, and flapping their wings. Feathers of all kinds and colors filled the chicken coop. Terrified and with eyes tightly closed, we continued screaming while we stood against the locked chicken coop door. This commotion brought Mama running with a broom, while four barking dogs chased the evil rooster, last seen in a cloud of dust, running through the vineyards. The eggs? All were broken except for four, which landed in the straw next to the nesting boxes. Cookies and milk went a long way in taking the fright out of us, when at the very least punishment for breaking all the eggs was expected. Once composed, we were ushered out the door, as Mama had serious work to catch up on. Our mission quickly recalled, I reminded my sister, "Hey, we forgot about the ladyfingers." "Yeah," she exclaimed excitedly, "let's go." We raced across the lawn, dashing through the front gate and out to the vineyards. We had given little thought to the hot sand that was now beginning to burn our bare feet in the midday heat. Our targeted area was beyond the yard, across the front of the property, to the back, and down the long dusty road, which led to the north 40 acres at the back of the ranch. "Ouch! My feet are burning," I exclaimed. "Let's go back and get our shoes." We ran to a patch of grass underneath a small almond tree. Our burning feet immediately began to cool as we made contact with the green grass and shade. "We're almost there. Come on, we can make it." With that, she ran. I ran right behind her. We neared our targeted destination with feet on fire, but determined that if we did not keep an eye on the ladyfingers, the harvesters would beat us to them. It was our annual ritual. While we were not allowed to be on the narrow road that ended in the north 40 acres of the ranch, that dusty road was our destination to our prized sweet muscat, some Thompson grapevines, and the lovely long grape which we only knew as ladyfingers. Ladyfingers are similar to Thompson grape in flavor and are also seedless. Their shape is oval and long, similar to a lady's finger, consequently the name. The vineyard that bore the muscat and ladyfingers was very special, as Papa had interspersed a few of the vines with a couple of rows of muscat along the dusty path. These were the first rows of vineyard that separated our property from the neighbor's property line. We were especially not allowed on that path during harvest, as this was the route for all farm equipment, trucks, and tractors. Since it was only a couple of weeks to harvest, our daily mission would be to taste test each of the special bunches of grape we'd selected for sugar content and ripeness, almost as Papa did. We would occasionally catch a glimpse of him when he ran the simple test required before announcing the beginning of the annual harvest. He'd come in from the fields with a large, beautiful bunch of Thompson grape and reach up over the arbor off the kitchen entrance for a long, tubular glass beaker with blue numbers and lines running down both sides of it. He'd call to Mama, "Angela, una olla." Mama would present a sizable container in which Papa would then squeeze the grapes, extracting their juice. Sounding and looking just like a chemist, he'd then pour the juice into the vial with the blue markings on it, insert another long glass tube into the cylinder, and read those numbers to Mama. "Un poquito más. Les falta poca azúcar. Como unos 4 o 5 días, he'd say. "A little more. They need a little more sugar. About 4 or 5 more days. The harvest of the grapes that started the production of raisins was not yet ready to begin. Here we were again, checking the bunches of grapes we'd so carefully tagged as ours. I located one of mine very quickly. It was easily distinguished as it hung across a grape stake and over the thick wire that supported the vines. It rested near an empty dove's nest. My sister was now a couple of vines away checking a large bunch of muscat. I skipped over the hot sand around the vineyard through shady areas until I reached the vine where she stood. Reaching up to a bunch of muscat grape, I took the largest grape I could find and popped it into my mouth. "Not yet," I said, mimicking my dad. 3 more days, I yelled as I ran at a very brisk pace. "Wait," my sister yelled as she chased me down the dusty path. "I can't," I yelled back, looking over my shoulder. "My feet are burning." With intentions of skipping the worst part of the hot sandy path along the front of the house, I cut off toward the back of the house. There, the shade of the big eucalyptus tree behind the sprawling house met with the shade of the vineyard. "I said, wait for me," my sister continued to yell in frustration. I could hear the anger in her voice rising as she called out, "Wait till I catch up with you." Now running as for dear life, I continued and increased my pace, racing around and hopping over large rocks, shrubs, and equipment near the barn. I had entered the forbidden zone without thinking. This was another of the unsafe places on the ranch. My path carried me over the area where a large trash pile had recently been burned. Trying to run through it was a mistake, but trying to go around it would have seen me at the mercy of anger, of which I could not fathom the results. As I took one last jump, in effort to clear the pile of unrecognizable debris, I ended on the opposite side of the charred heap. I felt something piercing and quickly looked down to see blood pouring off the bottom of my right heel. I had landed on a large piece of glass. I immediately put my hand in the air in effort to stop my sister, who was now charging toward me. "Stop," I yelled. "You'll get hurt." "No, I won't. You just don't want me to catch you," she yelled as she took one long jump straight across the same debris pile and landed on a shard of glass larger than the one that had pierced my foot. We both looked down in horror at the blood now spilling from the exact spot on the opposite foot, the bottom of her left heel. Tears started out of her eyes. I began to laugh and hobble away at the same time, not knowing whether to be angry or cry. She also started laughing. We laughed so hard that we found it difficult to navigate our way back to the house, each of us hopping on one foot. Mama met us at the kitchen door, unsympathetic as she scrutinized our injuries. She was not happy. Hydrogen peroxide and sterile bandages were made ready. We were restricted to our bedroom. With heels medicated and white bandages that wrapped all the way up to our ankles, we could not move. My right foot and her left were elevated and rested against the bed's frames. We lay there, on beds we'd left only a few hours ago. While our intended sole mission of the day had been only to check on our lady fingers, we had no idea of the adventures we'd encounter. The cranky but oh-so-evil rooster, broken eggs, and our substantial war injuries kept us laughing and giggling all evening long. In a couple of days, we'd be well enough to return to our chores. More importantly, we'd return to the vineyard, along that dusty path, to check on our lady fingers.
Yes, I think to myself, what a wonderful
That was Earlene Holguin reading a memoir of hers entitled Vineyards of the San Joaquin Valley. In the first of her three childhood remembrances, Earlene gives us a first-hand look at what growing and picking grapes is really all about. How to dress when you're out to go picking grapes on those super hot days in August and September. The kind of knives you use, how to use your grape picking pan, and of course, what to do with those paper trays. At lunchtime, they all went down to the San Joaquin River, right by the railroad bridge, and sure enough, here comes a freight train. The conductor even waves at them, as though maybe he was wishing he too could be down there by the river having lunch. The second story tells us how the author's father, called in from working out in the field, had to take care of an emergency at the house. Evidently, a skunk had invaded the kitchen, and father finally shot the thing to smithereens, leaving a couple of holes at the base of the kitchen sink. And finally, Earlene tells us how one day their feisty rooster tried to stop her and her sister from collecting eggs out there in the chicken coop. They became so agitated, they dropped most of the eggs. Thank you, Earlene Holguin, for those memories of what life was and probably still is out there on many, many grape ranches right here in the valley. Folks, Earlene Holguin's father was a lifelong Madeira rancher who raised grapes for raisins. Earlene is a member of several local writing groups chaired by Janice Stevens, who, as I'm sure many of you remember, is no stranger to Valley Writers Read. Thank you, Earlene, for your intriguing remembrances. We hope you have more stories for us in seasons to come. And so we come to the end of another edition of Valley Writers Read. Thank you for listening. If you'd like to hear tonight's or any other Valley Writers Read story again, just go online to kvpr.org and click on to Valley Writers Read. Next week, our author will be David Borofka. In the meantime, this is your host, Franz Weinschenk, wishing you and yours a great life story until we meet again. Good night.
Valley Writers Read is a production of Valley Public Radio, produced by Don Weaver and Franz Weinschenk. Please join us again next Wednesday at 7 p.m. for another edition of Valley Writers Read.